Halo, halo, Sacred Icon listeners. We used to do ads for other people, but I decided, why don't we do one for ourselves? Whether you're here listening to us for the first time or you've heard every episode, I'd like to briefly tell you what we're about and how you can support us. We have been doing this podcast since 2019, and with that has come lots of changes. We started as a primarily Halo-only show, but have evolved, combat evolved, over the years to talk about a wide variety of things in the realm of nerd culture. As you can imagine, we've made numerous changes to our platforms, usernames, and emails over the years, so now is the time for me to set things right and give the Covenant back their bomb. You can join our Discord by clicking the link included on our podcast feed. You can also send us an email or a voice message at sacrediconpodcast@gmail.com. We have a YouTube channel at youtube.com/sacredicon, and we no longer use Twitter or X or whatever else the kids are calling it these days. So if you see someone who looks like us there, just know it's not us. Lastly, you can support us on patreon.com/sacredicon and receive a bevy of bonus content. We're so glad you chose us to be the voice in your ear on this particular day and hope you enjoy the episode ahead.
Keep it secret. Keep it safe. Keep it sacred, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of the Sacred Icon Podcast. We are back here on Sacred Saturday to cover a topic that's actually pretty near and dear to Brian and I's hearts. It's a co-op experience we share together. Not too many of those we've had topics on, really, outside of Halo or going to a movie on the podcast, but this one is specifically a game. We're heading back to Middle Earth, and we're going to be talking about Lord of the Rings, War in the North, that released in 2011. Now, before we get into things, let me give you a little brief narration. Then I'm going to kick it over to my boy Brian. He's going to set us up. We're going to have some fun this episode. Of the great War of the Ring, many songs have been sung and many tales told. The names of heroes like Gandalf the Grey, Aragorn the King, and Frodo the Ringbearer are greatly revered.
And rightly so!
Yet Sauron's grasp stretch much further than the lands of Gondor and Rohan alone, and his forces might have done great evil in the north of Middle-earth, and it had a handful of heroes that didn't have a handful of heroes that stood in his path. I read that wrong. Their stories, too, though, deserve to be told. I don't know where I fell off the wagon here, but I've already done it. Pay heed now to one such tale, which begins in the town of Bree, just a few short days before Frodo arrived on his quest. Now, guys, the producer of this game once explained this setting as, at the end of Return of the King, Gandalf mentions a great battle that took place in Erebor, and says that if the dwarves and men there hadn't won that battle, the war could have been lost even if the One Ring had been destroyed. Frodo's quest was extremely important, but everyone in Middle-earth was drawn into the War of the Ring. Even Lothlorien, which was remote and well-protected, was attacked during the war. The fact that the whole world was at war is what we're drawing on for War in the North. Tolkien's work mentions dwarves living in the Grey Mountains, and that the orcs had a capital city at Mount Gundabad, and that the Witch King of Angmar had once ruled a large part of the North. So we're using that canon as the foundation of our story. Brian, how do you feel about talking about War in the North, getting nostalgic, and what do you think about War in the North overall, man?
Well, this is a really interesting topic for us, guys, because I think, you know, we've talked a lot about, like, how, you know, like, ratings and scores for video games and how, like, oh, everything seems to fall into that, like, 7 to 10 rating. And and one of the things that I and other people say is, well, I don't really usually play games that are bad or games that aren't exceptional. I usually just play the heavy hitters of the year. Well, you know, like, this year it'd be Spider-Man, Baldur's Gate, Zelda, Starfield. So you usually just experience games that are like of that high, you know, tier. But what's interesting about today's episode is we're talking about Lord of the Rings War in the North, which is a game that by no means is bad, but it really it fails to be one of those big tentpole games that people talk about often. I mean, this might be the only time you've heard about anyone talking about War in the North in years, if ever. But the thing is, this game provided us with such a special experience. The experience, the memory is even better than the game. This game's probably, I don't know what Josh said recently, I'll let him say now. This game's probably like a, maybe when it released it was like a 7 out of 10, but maybe it might be more like a 6. Or
I saw IGN gave it a 7. I watched.
What do you think at launch? Like, I know not now, but like at 2011, what do you think this game, what would you have given it, Josh? Like, might be, it's probably lower, isn't it?
Oh, Josh, you back then? Probably a 5 or 6. Probably 6. I think a 6.
It's very like, it's kind of a very average game with maybe moments of above average, but it is the first attempt to make a big budget Lord of the Rings game based on the movies that is not done by EA. So when the rights for the movie version of the video games left EA, WB started development on Lord of the Rings War in the North. And this was to be, like I said, like the first big budget Lord of the Rings game that used the movies as a backdrop, and it wasn't bound by EA, and they used Snowblind Studios to develop the game, which Snowblind is really only known for one game, and that's Baldur's Gate Dark Alliance. They're of Baldur's Gate Dark Alliance fame, and they were brought on to develop this game, and this game had an uphill battle for a few reasons. One, Lord of the Rings, while it's always popular, it wasn't in its, like, cultural peak when, like, Two Towers and Return of the King came out. This was 2011, so, you know, even the Hobbit movies hadn't really, you know, they hadn't started yet. So it wasn't at its peak. Snowblind Studios, while I wouldn't say is a bad studio, they're not, like, known for, you know, creating complete epics or anything that people talk about a lot. So it had a unfamiliar studio, and it wasn't as in the mainstream topic as normal. And perhaps the biggest issue is that it came out like a week or two around the launch of a little game called The Elder Scrolls V Skyrim. So,
yikes.
Kind of hard to convince people to go spend $60 on a hack and slash movie tie-in Lord of the Rings game right around the time another epic AAA most hyped thing ever fantasy game was coming out. So not many people play this game. I don't think it did very well from what I've heard. I don't really know for sure. But what ended up happening after this game came out is WB took Snowblind Studios, absorbed them into Monolith, and then Monolith went on to create Middle-earth Shadow of Mordor, which was objectively a much better game. It was a Game of the Year contender that year. It had a higher budget. I think you'll meet plenty of people who enjoy Shadow of Mordor and Shadow of War, where you don't hear anyone talk about Lord of the Rings, War in the North. But War in the North was that first attempt at the AAA Lord of the Rings game, this late on. But for me, well, I'll admit, War in the North was not as good of a game as Shadow of Mordor or Shadow of War. I definitely appreciate it more because Lord of the Rings, War in the North really tried to be like faithful to, I could say the books, but maybe even the movies, probably because that's what the backdrop it uses. So it tries to not take too many liberties and really fit in with that, whereas Shadow of Mordor and War, they definitely took more liberties, but they were better games. You can play up to three-player co-op. You play as you guessed it, a man, an elf, and a dwarf. And the man is played by Nolan North, and the woman is played by Laura Bailey. So just like the most familiar voice actors ever. I don't know the guy who plays the dwarf. I read his name, but
Fred Tastescore.
Yeah,
I'm probably mispronouncing that.
Yeah, but basically the game. What's cool about this is prior games based on the movie, you had either it just having you replay scenes in the movie, like Two Towers or Return of the King. Or you had something like Third Age, the Lord of the Rings Third Age game, where it's like you're basically just B-Team Fellowship going through all the same events behind them, where it's like you're not really Aragorn and Gimli and Legolas, but you look like them, you sound like them, you go to the same places and do the same things. Well, with War in the North, they try to do it a little differently. On one hand, you could say you're B-Team Fellowship in the sense that you're a man, a dwarf, and an elf, but they send you on a specific mission to the north, which, as Josh mentioned, is something that Gandalf had said that, you know, there's, if it hadn't been for the work that was done in the north, you know, Sauron could have, you know, made a lot more progress in his takeover. So you're doing, you know, it's its own story that feels like it could fit in with the movie. You do get to visit places like Rivendell still, but it doesn't feel like you're following the Fellowship and just repeating the same events. You get to go do your own special things. It's basically hack and slash third person gameplay. So the whole game's in third person. You have a heavy attack. You have a fast attack, a block. You have a bow and arrow. Pretty standard stuff. It's very down the middle type of game. But me and Josh decided, I think it was Josh's idea, because I remember it as your idea. Josh was like, well, we were talking about this game a little bit. We'd never really played it. I might have tried it once. I can't remember. But we didn't own it. We hadn't played it through. And Josh was like, well, it's only like $15 for a brand new copy of this game. And your birthday's coming up, Brian. How about I buy us both a copy and we co-op this thing? You know, because neither of us thought it was going to be that great of an experience. So we're just like, you know, $30 total, two copies. We'll hang out and we'll just have fun with it. And that's what we did. And we got together. At the time, I was living with my parents. I had this big, awesome, like, bachelor pad in my parents' basement. We set up two Xboxes, two TVs, and we both started this game. I believe I played as the Aragorn-like character, right?
Do you remember? Yeah, so the main three characters' names were Aradon, which was the ranger, Andriel, which was the female elf, and Farron, which was the male dwarf. And yeah, you took Aradon, and I took Farron, if I'm not mistaken. I think okay. I played just the dwarf.
And then the NPC was Andriel, the elf. But we started playing this game, and, you know, it's one of those things where you start it off and the graphics are cool, and it gives you, like, a story background, and you start playing, and you kill a couple guys, and you're like, holy shit, this is awesome, we're gonna have such a blast. And then after, like, an hour or two, you're like, oh, it's kind of just pressing these same two, three buttons and going through the same motions over and over again. So it's a very, like, it is a licensed movie game. It's not like, you know, like, Middle-Earth Shadow of Mordor, when that came out, that was very much like a full-on AAA video game that used the IP. This was like more selling on the IP than it was the game, if that makes sense. Like, Shadow of Mordor was a good game, even though it wasn't Lord of the Rings. This is like, well, if this wasn't Lord of the Rings, there's really not much reason to visit this game. But we had so many great memories playing it, and we talk about it. I mean, it's been, wow, next year I think it'll be 10 years since we played it.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, because to put it in a place in the timeline, guys, we played it prior to the Master Chief Collection coming out, but I think also prior to the Battle of the Five Armies coming out. So somewhere there in 2014 is when I think it happened.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, no, 2014 was when... Yeah, you said Battle of Five Armies, you're right. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so it's been about 10 years. And the thing is, me and Josh never forget this game. And we never stopped. We still talk about it all the time. And we both acknowledge that it's not really that exceptional of a game. And I wouldn't necessarily recommend it to someone just on like, ah, oh, yeah, play this by yourself, you're going to have a blast. It's dope. But we will talk highly of it because of how much the experience meant to us. Unfortunately, if any of you listen to this episode and you want to play it, you only have two options, and that's to, well, I guess three. Play it on a 360, play it on a PS3, or you can get it for PC. But there's no backwards compatibility through the Xbox One, Xbox Series X, which is a crying shame, because if it came out right now for backwards compatibility, I'd be like, I'm going to push everything aside and play this game. And then I'd play it for a couple hours and probably go back to The Witcher 3. But it's still a cool thought and concept. But Josh, what do you think, what sticks out to you before, you know, I got kind of go into some more stuff? Like, what sticks out to you about this game, about the memories? Why did we like it so much?
Well, I'm checking real quick to see if it's on Steam, just out of curiosity.
I think I own it on Steam. They might have quit selling it, but I think I own it on Steam.
Yeah, I can't tell. It doesn't almost make it seem like it's not on sale on Steam.
I think you have to go buy the CD key, because I don't think you can buy it through Steam anymore.
Oh, bummer. But, yeah, really, I had a great time with this game. This was a really cool thing for us to do in 2014 when we were waiting Master Chief's Collection to come out, and we were in the midst of that Hobbit, Middle-Earth kind of euphoria. This was a really great experience for us to tackle, and in a way kind of surprising that we hadn't prior. So, but I do vaguely remember when Brian and I worked together, I think he was talking about it, and there was a limited edition they did, and it was like this Ranger edition, I think, and it came with this, like, quiver, I think it was. Do you remember that, Brian?
Yeah, it was a quiver. Yeah, actually, right here on the Wikipedia, it says...
Yeah, go and read that.
The collector's edition comes in a Ranger quiver case and includes a concept book, a behind the score DVD, interesting, featuring interviews with... Oh, yeah, featuring interviews with Einon Zur, the guy who did Starfield, is actually who did the music for this game. And footage of the score being recorded at Abbey Road Studios, as well as a concert event from E3 2011, plus three complete tracks. Digital content for the PlayStation version includes War in the North wallpaper, fonts and icons, and a Xbox 360, a Ranger avatar for Xbox Live. So this game was like, I mean, I don't feel like anybody really remembers it much, especially like it was coming out right around Skyrim, but this was really... trying to be pitched as like, this is the good Lord of the Rings game. This is the AAA game you've been waiting for. Here's this big collector's edition. I, at one point, like Josh said when I was talking to him, at one point I was like, I'm thinking about buying it. It was like, I think it was $79.99, which now seems so cheap for a collector's edition with a full-on quiver and shit. Like, that's basically a that's basically a freaking regular game now. But I didn't end up getting it.
You also got the game with it, which, unlike nowadays, sometimes you don't. But or at least there for a while, but... Yeah, I vaguely, and I could be misremembering this, guys, but I vaguely remember Brian wanting to get it, and then he canceled it, I think, because Skyrim was coming out, and we were all looking forward to Skyrim, and that just took over. And I think, looking back, that's also probably why this ended up kind of getting washing over us, really, because otherwise, any other time there was a Lord of the Rings title, typically, is something that, whether independent or together, it's something that Brian and I were going to jump on, but... This game was pretty excited for reasons Brian already mentioned, but until 2009, Vivendi owned the rights to the book versions of the Lord of the Rings. They had put out the very first Lord of the Rings Fellowship of the Ring game that kind of coincided with the film, although it was an adaptation of the book and not the film itself. But they had the rights for the longest time, so like Brian said, anytime EA put out something that was Lord of the Rings... it was capitalizing off the movies, and it was only doing things within the movies and the characters of those films. So this was really one of the first times where they got to take stuff from the books and sort of the license of the movies and the aesthetics of that and kind of blend those two together. So you do have parts in the game where you are seeing, like, for example, the beginning of the game, your characters are meeting Aragorn in Bree. You go to the Prancing Pony, and that's kind of where you kick off your adventure, and it's got the likeness of Viggo Mortensen. So it does have the likeness of a lot of the actors from the films, which is very, very cool. This was the first time this happened. Maybe in... I'm actually not sure, Brian. Aragorn's Quest might technically be the first one that did this.
I think it looked like him, but... I mean, the Return of the King and Two Towers game obviously had his likeness.
Right, but I mean... I'm not sure. Aragorn's Quest was kind of... I got to see the release date, but what I'm trying to say is one of these games were the first ones to use the likeness of the films to tell a wholly original story that was
to do
films. And Aragorn's Quest was kind of dancing around that a bit.
Yeah.
And when did that come out? That came out in 2010. So I suppose, in a way, technically that's first. But suffice it to say, this game was really, really cool once we played it. We didn't really know what to expect going into it, but... I bought the game for us. We go over to Brian's. We're in the basement. And we told the story before about how we watched the Remaking the Legend of Halo 2 documentary. Yeah. And he had a television off to the left that our friend Ryan was over trying to play Shadow of Mordor on. And so basically, for frame of reference, I'm over on that left screen in Brian's room. And Brian is on his big TV. So we're sitting there adjacent to one another, side by side, playing this game. And one of the most interesting things was about it was that you do have, your combat scenarios, if you're familiar with the Dark Alliance titles, the hack and slash, you have that, but then you also had hub areas where you would essentially get to go around and talk to NPCs, merchants, and pick up quests. And the thing that was interesting about that was when you talk to people, it has sort of a dialogue tree, a little bit similar to, I would say, Mass Effect. And if I'm doing that as, say, my dwarf, Farron, Brian's not getting locked into that conversation on his screen. He's not having to watch that. So it doesn't take his agency away. It would let him roam around and go talk to a character if he wanted to. So it was kind of interesting because what Brian and I ended up doing pretty fast, I remember, was if someone was close to an NPC and we're just going to talk to them, say Brian was up close to Gandalf, then I would just stop what I'm doing and watch his screen. We'd both watch his screen to see that conversation unfold. And that was because Brian and I didn't really want to miss anything in Middle Earth. We were trying to get the most out of it. So we kind of had that game plan early once we realized what the game had going for it, what the approach was. And I just remember having a lot of fun doing that. The hub stuff in particular was quite fun because there you get to... I remember Rivendell in particular, which we'll get into later, but that was really a treat, I think, mm-hmm. to see. But like you said, Brian, it was really cool because it was essentially the first time we ever got to play a Middle-earth game where it had the likeness of the films that we loved, but you were actually getting to do something original and not just being always just a step behind the Fellowship or just being them themselves. It was really fun in that regard.
Yeah, it's very clear that they really tried to make this something special, but just a combination of it just not having it didn't land its concepts well enough, and it came out in a horrible time. I think here this perfectly summarizes it. I don't remember us experiencing any bugs. That's the only thing I'll say that I don't really particularly agree with. But it says here on the Wikipedia page, the game received mixed reviews, with critics praising the graphics and tone. I think the graphics and tone are awesome. Like, that's one of the things that drew me in about the game, is it felt like, you know, I'm in the Middle-earth films. It says, but criticizing the repetitive combat, it is very repetitive, weak storyline. I thought the storyline was fine, not exceptional, but, you know, it was enough to get me going, and poor character development. The main characters you play as, me and Josh, cannot recall anything about three of them developing in any way, shape, or form. They were very cookie-cutter bland, just something for you to play as, so... That's a very fair statement. It says it was also criticized for containing several game-breaking bugs, which we don't recall at all. War in the North was a commercial failure, which some attributed to the timing of its launch among other high-profile releases,
such as Skyrim.
there was other games around there, too. Like, I mean, there was a Call of Duty that year, obviously, around that time. There was a Batman Arkham City, a couple months prior, like Gears of War 3 had come out, Rage... Lots of games that came out during that time.
Yeah, Portal 2, Skyward Deus Sword. Ex, Human Revolution, Dead Space 2, Gears of War 3, The Witcher 2, Crysis 2, Dead Island, Warhammer 40,000, Skylanders, Harry Potter and the Deathly... Oh, no, never mind. That one didn't go over well. Dragon Age 2, though. Assassin's Creed Revelations, Dark Souls, Call of Duty Modern Warfare 3, LA Noir, Arkham City, like you said.
Yeah.
Uncharted 3. Oh, my gosh, dude. Yeah, I better stop.
Who was going to pick up this game for $60 around all those bangers? Especially when it's a studio most people don't know.
Not to mention a little game called Halo Combat Evolved Anniversary.
Halo Combat Evolved Anniversary. Yeah, so...
Wow. What a year for 2011 game.
Horrible time. I'm interested to hear how many copies it sold. If I had to guess, it sold over 1 million, but the budget, the expectations would have been much higher than that. Let me kind of give you guys a little bit more details to kind of paint what this game is before we continue to share our experience with it. I'm going to kind of skip around the Wikipedia page a bit to give you some ideas. Some of this we've already talked about, but it says, the game contains narrative elements unique to both the novel and the films. Although the aesthetic design is based more specifically upon the look of the films, with characters in the game bearing the likenesses of the actors who portrayed them in the films. The game does not directly adapt the story depicted in the novel and films, but instead depicts a trio of adventurers whose quest runs parallel in the main narrative, occasionally intersecting with it. The story follows them as they attempt to track down and defeat a powerful black Numenorean named Agendower.
Agendower!
Every time you hear his name in the game, it's like, Agendower!
It's pretty cool.
Sauron has employed to lay waste to the northern regions of Middle-earth, whilst Sauron himself concentrates on Rohan and Gondor. So it's cool to think you're doing this quest with original characters alongside the same time the events of the movies are playing out, but your stuff actually, you know, it matters. It says all characters have a light and heavy attack. All three can roll, block, and sprint.
Thank God they can roll.
Right. Players can also perform critical strikes. When a yellow indicator appears over the head of an enemy, a heavy attack will produce a critical strike. During a single-player game, players may issue orders to their AI companions. This was another thing that made this game seem really cool before it came out, is that you were going to be able to, for the first time ever in, it seemed like, any Tolkien media, there was a huge emphasis on the eagles in this game. Mm-hmm. And there's an eagle in this game that you save very early on, and then you get to use him throughout the game with his AI controlled to help you fight in battles.
Gwarhir, wasn't it? Wasn't his name Gwarhir?
No, Gwarhir is the main eagle from the books.
You save a different one prior.
You save the one you use is a.
It's been a while.
Yeah, it's been a while. But
you know what also is neat?
What's that?
Do you remember that you get to meet the two twin sons.
Oh, yeah.
Of Elrond's, Eladon and Elrohir.
Yeah, it really mixed the books and the movie in a cool way. And it always felt like on one hand, like, it's, on one hand, it's, of course, it's easy to tell that Tolkien didn't write the story. But on the other hand, like, nothing about this game makes it hard to believe, really, that these events transpired. You know, it's pretty faithful.
I think that's one of my favorite things about this is, even though I said before, like, this has taken elements from the books, it's really only just taken the excerpt where Gandalf mentions the War in the North. They're just taking their own narrative to fill out that and kind of bring substance to that statement. And that's what I love about it. They actually took a sort of canon event and decided we're gonna fill out that world and play in that sandbox. And that's what I liked about it right away, was just getting to see these original characters, even though, like Brian also said, the three protagonists are very uninspired, guys. They're not anything fun to look at. They're not all that interesting. I mean, just so bland. And you have real it's just essentially a copy-paste of Aragorn, like Brian said, too. Almost a Tariel. I want to say Tariel. But Arwen and Gimli. But the rest of the game, I think, makes up for the lack of inspiration, I think, that's there for those main protagonists. And it's kind of strange in that way, too, because when you're playing throughout a lot of the story, you know, yeah, you do have moments where you are running into certain characters that you would recognize from the films. But again, they're doing their own thing. So it is a bit strange to me that for as much as it seems like they try to tell this wholly original story and almost take a chance in that direction, the characters that you play as are something very safe that they don't take chances with, you know, they're not letting you, you know, they're not letting you get wholly creative with those characters. But at the same time, when you're in combat hacking and slashing, you know, it doesn't really matter. You're not thinking about it. It's primarily only in cutscenes and conversations that you have to see their face, but it is a lot.
I think it's interesting, you know, people criticize combat of, like, Witcher. I have myself, just saying that, like, it's not, you know, it's not top-tier combat, but, like, Witcher combat, you know, it's leagues beyond what they do here. You know, this is, like, this is very much the, hey, we've looked at the last 15 years of games where you press Y for heavy attack and X for fast attack, and we've adapted the same thing. Like, it's very unoriginal, very repetitive. Josh, I was reading this. I thought this was very interesting. Frodo Baggins is voiced by the guy who voices Spider-Man in the Insomniac games.
Yuri?
Yep.
Wow. Very cool.
And then also, guess who? So Gwahir is in the game, but the one that you constantly summon is Baron Thor. That's the eagle you summon.
Okay.
But Gwahir is in the game, and guess who voices Gwahir?
Who?
Agent Locke from Halo 5. Ike Amadi.
Wow.
Yeah. So,
see, guys, that's how you know Brian's a bigger fan. I was going to say Mike Coulter, and I forgot.
Mike Coulter, yeah.
I always forget
they're
that.
They're different, yeah. I believe here, if my memory serves me right, the guy who voiced Baron Thor, the eagle that you summon, is the one who went on to voice Gollum in Shadow of Mordor, Leon.
Well, I saw that Elodon and Elrohir was voiced by, I got to roll the R, was voiced by Liam O'Brien, who, like Laura Bailey, was also part of Critical Role, so that's pretty cool.
Cool. But so the development, the game was first announced March 18th, 2010.
Well, I was going to say, I'll chime in here and want to say one thing. This was so funny. We've told this story before. This was so fun about the game is you actually run into Radagast the Brown in the game.
Oh, well, okay, Josh. I was going to tell this.
You can tell the story.
No, you go ahead and tell it, but I was going to say, We have four main stories that stick out in this playthrough.
Okay, if you want to build up to that, I'm fine with it, Brian.
Well, you know, you can start with that one, but that's one of them.
Okay. Well, we can start with that one then.
Okay, go ahead.
So, yeah, there's Radagast the Brown in the game, and he is nothing at all like the one in the Hobbit films, because at this point when the game was in development, you know, I think this is technically before even the first, you know, Hobbit film comes out. So
they probably knew what Radagast looked like because they're part of WB Studios and the Hobbit movie would have already been in production, but they chose not to make him look or act like the one in the films. Go ahead, Josh.
Yeah. Well, he looks completely different. Suffice it to say, he looks a bit like Gandalf, albeit slightly differently, but doesn't have a hat, doesn't have bird shit on his head, isn't trying to get high.
He's not goofy.
He's a pretty laid back dude, and he was actually very cool.
I'll let you
tell the story better, Brian, because I think you do a better job telling it. But it was a very funny moment in the game. You want to tell them what happened?
Yeah, so, I mean, because we played this after the Hobbit movies had come out, or at least a couple of them. And if any of you who remember watching the Hobbit movies, Radagast is goofy, silly, squabbling. He's got bird shit going down his face from his head.
He's always a Razgabel rabbit.
Silly. He's always
like to see them try.
He's always getting high and all that stuff. And for me, before the Hobbit movies came out, whenever I pictured Radagast in my head, I pictured, oh, he probably looks like Saruman and Gandalf, which is another old man, except instead of white or gray, he's in brown, and he cares specifically for nature. So I always pictured this serious wizard donned in brown who cared about nature. And so when you get the Hobbit movies, it's like he's a complete goofball, you know, with shit going down his face. Well, then you play this game, and so for the first time, it's probably a little over halfway through the game, me and Josh meet Radagast, and Radagast shows up, and he is literally what I thought Radagast would always be. He's a serious wizard donned in brown who just has an affinity for nature. And because of my OCD and how much I loved the Hobbit movies, as soon as we meet Radagast in the game, the thought that goes into my head is, holy shit, this Radagast is cooler than the ones in the movies. And then my brain went, no, Brian, the movies are more important. You can't think that. Don't think that. And then as soon as my brain stops arguing with itself, Josh goes, damn, I think I like this one better than the one in the movies. And I'm like, damn it, Josh! And he's like, what? And I'm like, dude, like, I was thinking the same thing but didn't want to admit it to myself. And Josh started laughing and was like, we both agreed, like, this was a cooler representation of Radagast in the movies. We loved the movie one, but, like, this felt like Gandalf, you know?
Yeah, there. For frame of reference, guys, he actually looks a bit like Alan Moore, the creator of Watchmen. Just he's got that big long hair, kind of parting, and then a big long beard. And it was so cool because when you meet him in the game initially, it goes into this really epic cutscene of like him with his hands, I think, outstretched, and he's like summoning, I think, like a bunch of birds or animals. But like it really goes to show the mysticism and sort of the Mr. Rogers vibes he kind of cultivates with nature. And it was just, that was the moment where it was just like Brian and I are sitting there watching this silently together. And I'm just like thinking to myself, damn, like I love The Hobbit. I was actually really into the first Hobbit movie, but I'm like, he doesn't look any. This is what I wanted him to be like.
See, and
I
felt like. My problem with the bird shit is it. The problem with the bird shit, other than the fact that you're literally staring at a guy who has bird shit caked down his face, mm-hmm. is it shows. If, to me, it makes it feel like the wizard doesn't respect himself. And that's not how I pictured Tolkien's wizards to be. I would think he'd be self-respecting. Not necessarily selfish, but to let birds land on you and shit down your face and do nothing to clean it up just didn't really seem like how Tolkien would have went about it. So we liked this version in the games much better.
Yeah. Oh, he was great looking. And you're rescuing him from like spiders, I think.
Yeah.
Out there in Mirkwood. So yeah, it was a really, really cool moment. And it was just it's a really funny time because every time after that we would see the Hobbit movies and we'd talk about Radagast at any point with the bird shit, you know, we always talked about how much, like, too bad he wasn't like the one in War in the North. I mean, I think, honestly, the best thing to come out of War in the North was they have the best version of Radagast so far, you know?
That we've ever seen.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
He was really cool, and it was a highlight moment of the game. It's pretty far into the game that you see him, but
that's what, man, I'm saying. It's awesome. Like, me and Josh have gaming memories to last forever from this very mid game. Like, this is actually an appropriate time to use the word mid. War in the North is a mid game.
That's fair.
It's not bad. It's not good. It's just kind of mid. I mean, it's closer to good than bad, I guess I'd say. But yeah, so that was one of our memorable moments. Another one was we were probably like, I don't know, a few hours into this game. You know, we'd already acknowledged that it wasn't the best game ever, but we were just having a fun time co-oping it. And our friend Justin, who you guys have heard on the podcast before, he came over to my house. He called me. He's like, hey, you mind if I come over and chill with you guys? We're like, yeah, no problem at all. And I think he thought, and it's kind of rational, I think Justin thought, they're playing this War in the North game, which who gives a shit about it, right? So he probably thought he was going to come over and just chill and have a good time with us, but me and Josh were locked into this game, taking it seriously like it was a new Mass Effect or a new Bethesda game or something. We were like, be quiet during the cutscenes, make sure you go through all the dialogue options, want to hear it all. And basically Justin came, he sat on the floor with his laptop, and we told him politely, we're like, we don't want to talk once there's a cutscene or dialogue. Well, there was cutscene and dialogue happening so much, it basically just ended up with Justin just sitting on the floor, not being able to interact with us at all. Now, to be fair to us, we were already doing that, you know, before he came over, but also to him, it's like, he was probably shocked that, like, we were taking this game so seriously that we were just zoned into it. But we were having a really good time with it. So he ended up going home after like an hour. He was like, well, nothing interesting for me to do here. So that was one part. That just shows how invested we were. Another thing that was kind of funny is when we got to Rivendell in the game, you know, we already got these vibes that like, okay, this isn't a, you know, this isn't a triple, like it is a triple A game, but it's like, it's not the quality of like a Skyrim or something like that. So we're expecting some silly things to come out of the game. And we're talking to Gandalf in Rivendell and we're going through all this dialogue. And there's one part where Gandalf goes, some people thought that we should just throw the ring into the sea, you know, instead of trying to destroy it or wear it or use it, like just toss the ring into the sea. And I immediately like stopped the game and I go look over at Josh and I'm like, dude, this is so ridiculous. Tolkien would have never suggested that or wrote that. That's so out of Tolkien. Like, it's ridiculous. And it goes to show how much I know, because he literally says that in the book. Tolkien did write that, that there were many who suggested the best thing to do is to take the ring far out into the sea and toss it. So it's just funny that me, because Josh, I mean, I set it up, but Josh agreed with me. He was like, oh, yeah, that's silly. Like, he'd never do that.
I thought to myself, like, didn't we see that at the beginning of the Return of the King movie? Like, that's
like, with it being in the lake or whatever? Yeah.
Yeah, but
yeah,
I feel so bad for Justin because I think we did preface, to be fair, that when he hit us up or he hit Brian up and was like, hey, is it cool if I come on over, just chill for a bit? Because Justin used to live like not even 5 minutes away from Brian from him. And Brian was like, yeah, well, Josh is over. We're playing War in the North right now in co-op. But yeah, man, go ahead and come over. So he comes over and then I'm over here in that phone call and I'm like, oh, fucking cool as hell. Like, this is going to be awesome. And then Justin comes over and right at that time that he has come over is when we have gotten to Rivendell in the game. And Rivendell is probably the biggest hub in the game that you go to. And this, they almost have essentially at this moment in the game, their own sort of council where you are talking to Elrond and Gandalf, and then you're running around and you're talking to all these other NPCs like Arwen and just picking up quests and everything. And it was such a ill-timed experience because for Brian and I, we can't progress forward in the game. We would have had to essentially put all the game aside just to hang out with Justin. But then at the same time, you know, for Justin, it's like, well, then that's not fun for him when we're just sitting there staring at our screens, listening to these animated characters talk to us. So it was just a bummer, I think, for Justin, because we chatted with him briefly, but we were so focused on dialogue. And, you know, when you're playing this stuff for the first time, you don't know how long it's going to stretch out, but it turned out to be a really long time of talking to all these characters and kind of setting up the plot, because it was, you know, just like Fellowship in its own way. It has you getting to Rivendell, and then that kind of progresses your adventure in terms of
finding out what's next. Well, I think Rivendell was probably the most heavy NPC dialogue section in the whole game, and that's when he showed up. I mean, yeah. We must have spent an hour or more there talking to everybody.
So, yeah, you guys do go to a couple different locations, being Fornost, Samford. You get to the Barrow Downs, which is cool, Rivendell, the Ettenmorge, Mount Gundabad, Nordenbad, Mirkwood, Lorien. Some of these are challenges. I can't remember for sure. I'm just flipping through this video. I'm actually watching gameplay.
You get to have
Urgot's Lair
in dialogue conversation Carnton. With another dragon that lives under a mountain. It's not
so cool. But yeah, it was really a bummer, you know, timing for Justin. And he just decided, well, I'm going to go home. We were like, dude, I'm so sorry, man. So sorry. It's just we're at this point. We were explaining to him and everything was fine. But yeah, it was just a bummer moment. But we were really into this experience at this point. We were locked in. I want to say we played maybe three different sessions of this, three or four, finishing this. Hmm. And even though it was like online co-op, you know, we were connected online, but we usually try to play it in person just to get that experience as much as possible. And that's why part of it's so memorable for that reason. And it was really, really funny. And kudos to Brian, who typically doesn't always want to do everything A to Z, but he knew that that's something that I wanted to do. And he ended up getting a lot of fun out of it. So it was fun to sit there and I'm going to go talk to Gandalf. And then Brian's watching my TV. And then suddenly Brian's like, well, I'm right by. I found Arwen. And I'm like, oh, shit, Arwen? You know, and then we're watching, you know, him talk, his character talk to her. And he's making his dialogue choices and stuff. And it just kind of killed two birds with one stone. It was fun. I love that.
It was a blast. I think anybody who's like a big fan of Lord of the Rings could enjoy the experience of playing through this. Just seeing the world.
Brian.
What's that?
I'm looking at, again, I'm watching gameplays. We're recording, and I'm watching Gandalf and Rivendell talk to the characters. There's, like, aside from the characters you talk to, there is nothing there. Like, it is so lifeless. You don't see elves walking around. Like, in this era, I feel
we're
like
used to that now.
Yeah, exactly. We would get a lot of NPCs just walking around, maybe spouting one-liners, but there is nothing back there.
Well, you dude, see it's some crazy. By, but it's crazy it. Now after playing Starfield. Like, in Starfield, you go in a city, and there can be, like, 100 NPCs walking around.
Yeah.
But if you go back to Whiterun and Skyrim, there's like 7.
Do you think like they're all gone at a luncheon right now at this point in the game?
That must be it. The Elven luncheon. That's where Beaufort's singing and oh, Keeley thinks that the elf is hot, but it's actually a man, and then they all make fun of him.
You know what? Correct me if I'm wrong, but when you get to Rivendell, isn't this basically right after the Council of Elrond has had its council?
Yeah, they all the Fellowship has left the regular Fellowship.
And well, Aragorn's there. You're able to talk to him. So it must be before they're about to leave. I don't know, because going by the, again, this is going by the books. And I think in Fellowship, they did stay there for a few more days before they actually parted. Whereas the movie's like, yeah, we're going to go by nightfall.
Yeah.
kind of happens fast.
The movie has to expedite everything.
Yeah.
But then the last big memory I have of our playthrough is we beat the game. And the final boss is, it's not a spoiler really, because you're building towards it the whole game, is Agendower. And you have the eagle helping you summon the eagle in to fight this boss. And I can't remember what the decision was, but the way in which Josh and I decided to fight the boss and the decision we made led to Josh being locked out of an achievement, an endgame achievement. And Josh was so pissed.
Just like the Master Chief Collection in like a few months.
Yeah. Josh was so pissed that he was left out of the achievement that his OCD struck, and he looked over at me, and he was serious. He was not joking. He was like, would you want to replay through the game with me again to get that achievement? And I looked over at Josh, and I said, dude, there is no way I am replaying
just for the last section, though, like if we were able to reload or something.
My memory says it was the whole game, but I could just be remembering wrong.
I could be wrong, too.
Either way, I was like, dude, like, because the game is like, I mean, I'm guessing off the top of my head, it was like a 15, 20-hour experience.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very repetitive game, and it's, you know, it's not that great of a game. So I was ready to be done. And Josh is like, we got to go back, and we got to get this achievement. And I'm like, no, no. And then Josh goes, well, when I get home, I might play it myself. And I'm like, you have fun with that. And to my knowledge, Josh never booted it back up again. He's like, nah, it's not worth going back and getting it myself. But it was a really fun experience. I feel like the story was interesting enough, and I love the setting and tone and graphics. I do think the weakest part of the game is either the repetitive combat or the characters that have no personality. But I would say
personalities bite, bro. There's just nothing there.
I would almost say the combat's the worst thing though, because I don't think the characters really needed to have personality or development that much. They were just kind of a vessel for us to experience the world. It's just the combat that, like, because the combat's fun. If you ever played a hack and slash, you know, heavy attack, fast attack, block, it was fun, but it was like, you know, when you're 15, 20 hours in, I mean, you are really over it because the combat doesn't evolve in any way. You don't really get upgrades or new ways to fight.
You do get upgrades in there and stuff like that, and you do have to go sometimes to
Well, isn't it? It's upgrades, but you can't, like, it doesn't change how the game's played at all, right?
No.
No, like, new attacks or new spells or anything like that.
There might have been, see, that's what I can't remember. I don't know how theirs was treated, like if it was just talent trees, like passive stuff, or if it was more like you get some new combo animation thing. I can't recall.
Yeah.
But I remember you do having to go to like people like weaponsmiths, and you would have to sometimes pay to repair your weapons and stuff.
But I love the ambition of this game, though, because even though, I mean, you play it and you probably think it doesn't seem that ambitious, like I said, they were trying to take the book IP and the movie IP and marry them together in a AAA experience with high-quality voice acting and a collector's edition. And I want to read this excerpt here, which I think is cool, too. Josh kind of touched on it a little bit. It says, one of the ways in which the involvement of Middle-earth Enterprises manifested itself was in how conversations are handled in the game. When the player speaks to an NPC, the game uses a system similar to Mass Effect. See, they were pulling from, at the time, you know, 2000, I mean, I know Mass Effect 3 had some issues, but 2011, BioWare was pretty peak at that point. So they're pulling from BioWare here for their AAA Lord of the Rings game. Says, with the player given several response options from which to choose each time the NPC says something. However, whereas in Mass Effect there was a moral dimension in choosing a given response that would affect the development of the character, there is no such aspect in War in the North. Players can choose dialogue that will simply move the story forward, or dialogue that will fill in background information and expand on the lore in the game. So you can, much like, you know, your Mass Effects, your Bethesda games, your Witcher, you can choose the main dialogue option to continue the story, or you can ask all the additional stuff to learn more. The only difference is a lot of times you get new options or moral choices, whereas this game was just like, nah, if you go talk to this person more, you're just talking to them to get more information. It's not going to lead to any extra quests, any extra morality stuff. It's just pretty basic. It says Snowblind had initially planned to give players the option to choose rude responses and thus develop their character in different moral directions. However, the Middle-earth Enterprise was against that, arguing that in Tolkien, the heroes are always decent, kind people. As such, the developers abandoned the idea.
I like
so a little that. Bit was that. I like that too, because like I do. I think that it would be bad if I'm like B tier Aragorn and I'm like, nah, take care of yourself, you little shits. You know, like that doesn't seem to fit. But yeah, so I mean, it was a really ambitious game, I think, for the team. And I think ultimately, as much as I'm not a huge fan of the Middle-earth Shadow games, I think ultimately what this did was probably build a good base and a good understanding for what became Shadow of Mordor, which was, like I said, for me giving it crap, for all intents and purposes, Shadow of Mordor and by account Shadow of War that came after were really good games, AAA games that, at least Shadow of Mordor, it was in the Game of the Year conversations that year at the Game mm-hmm. Awards. It lost to Dragon Age Inquisition, but it was in there. Like in this game right here, War in the North, was not even going to be on the mentions for a Game of the Year. So this team being merged into Monolith and them going forward to make Shadow of Mordor. Shadow of Mordor had the Nemesis system. It had way better graphics and production values, and it was cool, you know. But I feel like I really admire how this game feels so true to War in the North, feels really true to Tolkien more, you know.
Yeah, it feels like a bit of an anomaly now in the midst of games that they've all done in the history of Middle-earth stuff. So, you know, because you this was kind of like in that stage, that very small, thin stage in between doing the movie license titles that they seem to keep milking for a while, even post the movies coming out in theaters. But then just before Shadow of Mordor came out, followed by Shadow of War. So it's just kind of interesting because it was trying to blend a lot of what came before in terms of just, you know, you're familiar with the movies. That's really how so many people of our generation got into this stuff. So there's the familiarity there aesthetically. And then you have now trying to take elements from the books. And for Brian and I at the time, who even though we knew a lot of TLDR stuff from the books, we didn't really sit down and read them. I had sped read through one in high school through study hall, but, you know, I was at school. I was like, I just want to be out of here. So I wasn't really thinking a whole lot about what was going on in the stories contextually. So it was really cool to see this, but again, it's something that just kind of flew under the radar, unfortunately, because games like Skyrim came out overtaking it. And as we saw earlier, or we mentioned earlier, so many great games. 2011 was another great year for games, apparently, which I don't recall, but I believe it. So this was awesome, though. And, you know, having fun with Brian getting to play it was a beautiful experience, because this just fell into that era of him and I getting together so much. Because you guys, you see, when we got, like, 2014 was just so special for us because we reconnected as friends at the very beginning. And we were playing a lot of, like, Halo 4 stuff as I got back into Halo. I was getting to play the multiplayer for the first time. We were starting to do a lot of Gears of War 3 Horde mode when I'd go over there. And we would ride that hype train. Sometimes we'd just go over. I'd go over there to hang out. Justin would come over. Creighton would come downstairs. And we'd all watch, like, Angry Joe videos. We'd watch, you know, some random movie. I think I watched, what is Dawn of the Planet of the Apes? I think that's the second one, correct?
At my house, yeah.
That's my favorite one. I just mix the titles up. But, yeah, we watched that one. And we were watching a lot of movies. Brian and Justin would get together for the Oscars, and they would get just this whole palette of food, you know, basically a smorgasbord, you know, and like dwarves just gobble it all up while they watched Oscar movies leading up to the Oscars. And so we were just always doing fun stuff in that basement. And this, again, was kind of in between that era of like, well, we're waiting for the last Hobbit movie to come out, and we're also waiting for Master Chief Collection. So much stuff is so exciting. You know, there's so much to look forward to in 2014 and 2015, but this was this random experience of like playing this old game together. And, you know, it's a lot like Resident Evil 5, I think, for a lot of people, in that a lot of people would say, well, Resident Evil 5 isn't that good of a game, but if you play it in co-op, it's a blast because, you know, you can sit there and spam a lot of the conversations where it's like, come on, come on, come on, come on, come on, come on. And you're just doing that. And I did that when I played with our friend Jeff, and it was freaking hilarious. I had so much fun in the infamous boulder punching scene and stuff. But so, I mean, that's kind of a mid-game to a lot of people, but it was made more fun because of the co-op experience. I feel like everybody has a co-op experience where the game was maybe mid or something to that effect, but because you played it with a friend or friends, it really made it memorable in your minds, and this was a good one for that. And one more story, and it's a sad one, is that the day that Brian and I were in his car driving back to his place to play this game, Brian gets a text from his dad and says, Robin Williams died. And Brian reads that off to me, and I'm like, what? And I'm getting on my phone, and I'm looking it up, and I'm seeing that stuff. And we've always loved Robin Williams. Who didn't? That's so sad. It's so sad. And the reason I remember this is because Brian took a picture of this game, just a quick screenshot of our character standing there on screen with his phone, and posted it on Facebook, just celebrating that we were playing this game together. We were starting our journey in Middle Earth, and it was on that same day that he died. And it's just kind of sad, and that's how I kind of remember that, too, is they're kind of linked together. Not that I associate them with one another, but they're just linked together in that memory. So it was really unfortunate. And at the same time we were playing the game and having fun starting it out, we were also kind of processing what we had just heard and learned. And also, you know, there's when you hear something like that, you know, just like when Heath Ledger passed, there was that part of me that was like, you're waiting for, like, the clock to tick and suddenly see an alert come through that, like, just kidding, JK. Yeah. You know, it didn't actually happen, you know, because it's still kind of strange.
It was hard to believe.
It really was.
I think it was harder to believe because, and let me preface here, I believe that when you die from suicide, you die from a mental illness. You die from it. Like, what I'm trying to say is I don't like when people say, oh, this person died of suicide. You know, they took their own life. It's on them. It didn't matter. I hate that because I think that's so wrong and so misinformed. You know, when you die from suicide, it's like dying from any other problem where something was seriously wrong with you and this is the result of it. I don't think it's selfish in the way people like to say it's selfish because you know, you hurt your friends and family, and obviously you do, but, you know, not to get too serious with that, but I just...
It's okay, you're fine.
He died of suicide, so I think that was why it also hit even harder, because this is the guy you know is to be the most jovial, most, you know, happiest guy around, and that's the way he passed away. So, yeah, I mean, we were on our way back with pizza, and that's what we had pizza and War in the North to keep us company through that.
We had a lot of fun experiences throughout that 2014 era, especially, and into 2015 too, but more so 2014. It was just a whole year of reconnecting. Brian and I talking constantly for hours on end on the phone. I mean, you know, pretty much where you're like, got your feet up on the wall, you know, like at that point, because you don't know what else to do. My battery's running low. I got to plug the charger in. We were talking for hours when we weren't hanging out. And he actually started, we reunited. We started out when we first met one another working at the same job. And then Brian went to some other jobs and kind of had a full circle comeback moment before he kind of leapfrogged into some other stuff. And so we were working together again around that time. So we would see each other at work. We were talking about Middle Earth stuff, Star Wars stuff, with other people. And then we would go and play, we would go talk on the phone. Then we were going out to eat and people were kind of being pulled into the conversations. And then we would go into that room and then we'd create all these cool memories playing these actual games, watching these movies and documentaries. And this one just stands out because it was really the only Middle Earth game we really ever got to like play together. You know, we had the experience of going to Shadow Mordor's like midnight launch, if you can even call it that. I think
what really stands out for me about War in the North, other than our memories, is that it's a game I respect. It's a mid game, and it's not something that's, you know, amazing, but I respect what it is because, you know, we've seen so many licensed games like Lord of the Rings Conquest. I didn't care for that. I did not respect that game really. You know, there was
a lot of Gollum. People like it though.
Gollum just came out this year, you know, like there's
I remember Hawes on High Potion giving me shit for that. I can't remember what he said.
He was like, you know, he's gonna be excited for that game.
Yeah. The Sacred Icon Boys or Josh or something like that.
That's what he said. But War in the North was a really it was an effort to make a good Lord of the Rings game with a AAA budget. And I know for any of you out there who really are nostalgic and reflect on those days of like Lord of the Rings being in the movie theater and the Two Towers and the Return of the King licensed games and Third Age coming out. This is the final hurrah for that era. This game right here. This is the last hurrah. Yeah, so if you haven't played it and you wanna like relive that experience again, this is the game to go back and play. Josh, don't look at them if you're on Wikipedia. But first of all, give me what is your score today, objectively, for War in the North?
Well, man, I'm watching gameplay right now, so you don't have to worry. But Gimli looks so tired, bro. He looks tired. Like, his face is uninspired here.
The whole time, Gimli's like, I'm tired, boss.
It's like they got the rights for everyone else, but John Rhys-Davies was unavailable at the moment.
Yeah.
You know? But my own score, you said, today?
Yeah, what would you... Yeah.
Four out of ten.
4 out of 10? Okay, I figured you, no matter what,
here's one for the people in the Discord. Great game. I had a blast. It's super fun. 4 out of 10.
But that's your objective, though. That's fair. You know what? And I knew whatever you said was going to be lower than mine. I was going to say, for me, this game is objectively a 5 out of 10. I think it is average, very mid, all the way through. It doesn't really do anything egregiously bad or wrong, and it doesn't really do anything new or innovative or interesting.
I think it plays it too safe, and I think the combat's very repetitive. I think those are the biggest cons. It tries to take some risks, though, which I commend it for, with a story, and it does have some really great story beats in it. It's just your protagonists are very unlikable just because they're very uninspired, and you have to see their faces so much because of all the dialogue.
You don't relate to them because there's no real character there. They might as well have been AI generated.
You're right. They're just blank vessels, empty vessels.
But what if you were to give it like on an emotional kind of subjective? Because for me, it's like a 7 if I'm going subjective.
Like in terms of how it made me feel?
Like, just what would you give the game out of 10 just subjectively because of your memories and your feel for it? 6? Okay.
Yeah.
So, we're both a step up, or two steps up from our score. Two steps up and one leg down. I don't know what that is, but so we're going to go through the
I don't know what that is. Let's move on.
Let's move on. Yeah. What the people were saying when this game came out. So, Josh and I said objective 4 out of 10 for Josh, 5 out of 10 for me. Some people were probably wondering, to get to this point in the episode, like, why are we talking about this game again, if that's where your guys' score is? Eurogamer, back in 2011, gave this a 4 out of 10, same as Josh. Game Informer, who usually gives things kind of skew high, in my opinion, they gave it a 5.5 out of 10. Kind of close
to you.
Yeah. Nice. GameSpot gave it a 6 out of 10. And IGN gave it a 7 out of 10. So IGN is the highest score at a 7. That was
How
not
do
surprising.
You feel that this game is essentially said to be on the same level as Starfield?
I thought you might say that, Josh.
I like the response.
That's funny. But I mean, Josh, we're in agreement, right, that like one score doesn't equal another, right?
It does not.
Yeah, it does.
I'm just jesting.
In a sense, like, okay, I don't think Starfield's a 7, but I think the best way I could explain that is a game like War in the North coming out in 2011 was a very, like, War in the North felt like an old game. It felt like something we'd experienced before.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, like, you know, you look at, like, on how the scale of how most people rate games, you look at a 5 out of 10, and that's kind of saying it's no more good than it is bad, no more bad than it is good. It strikes the middle balance, which isn't necessarily a good thing, but it doesn't mean it's necessarily bad. The rest is subjective in terms of how it's going to scale left or right. But if you say like a 6, which I think is kind of fair for a lot of people, it to me, like, that's almost for me, that would give it a 6 subjectively. That's almost my way of saying, like, well, for myself, I had far more of a fun time than I did bad. Not necessarily, I shouldn't say far more, but I had more of a fun time than I didn't with this game. And I would replay it, just not all the time. But it's been almost 10 years, so you're watching this gameplay, talking about it, it does make me want to play it again. But yeah, it's not something that you're going to want to do a lot, because the meat and potatoes that are there with its story is very cool on paper. but it's the execution of uninspired characters that, like you said, Brian, and actually you made a really good point about, it's just that there's no personality to them. So when you are having conversations, you're not really getting them. They're not, even in the sense of them being heroes, you're not seeing them excited one moment or down on the, down on the dirt just because they're really sad about, you know, the odds that they have to face. You don't really get a sense of scaling of where they're at in their headspace, their mental health, if you will. And then also, again, the combat is fun at first, but it does get very repetitive when you're seeing the same orcs coming at you. And, you know, you're 20 orcs later, it's the same ones, and you're like, oh, how many times do we have to teach you this lesson, old man? You
know, I'd go as far as to say that
it's fun.
I never experienced any bad moments in this whole game. The thing that makes it have such a middling score is that you're bored very quickly. There's really no moment where I'm like, oh, this sucks, or I hate this, or I don't want to play through this section. It's more like if I sit down to play this game, within an hour or two, I'm going to be like, oh shit, I've been mashing the same couple buttons with I'm getting bored. You know, I think that's why it took me and Josh so many sessions, is because, you know,
and the pacing issues too, right? Because yeah, you go from the repetitious combat over and over doing the same thing to we're in a hub world, we're playing in co-op, and Brian, you better, if you don't want to miss this, you better, I either have to wait for you to also talk to this person, or you got to watch this whole conversation that you're not taking part in. Put your controller down for about 5 to 10 minutes. Let me talk to this guy.
And most people aren't going to be in the same room because we were playing online, but we were next to each other.
And honestly, that's a huge problem I have with certain games, which I think is a pro and a con to this game in particular, is that the pro of the conversational aspect is that someone like Brian, who's not in a conversation that I might be in, he's not having his agency taken away online if he's at his house, and he's not forced to just watch the conversation I'm having. I can't remember for sure if you could maybe just like lean in and take part in it in terms of listening, kind of like how Baldur's Gate 3 does it today. But I don't think you could do that, but you were still able to go do stuff. But the con of that is, again, that there begins some pacing issues, you know? It's like when I've tried to play, like, Elder Scrolls Online with friends, and they have books in there the same way you have books in, you know, the regular Elder Scrolls series, you know, Skyrim, Morrowind, Oblivion, all that. Well, sometimes I might be the player, I'm usually the player that wants to read every book I come across, maybe not right away, but, you know, if it's not something I can take, well, I want to read it then and there. Or if I finish talking to a character and they give me a quest, I'll still actually approach them immediately right after just to get the dialogue of them saying, have you returned with the 3 vials I asked for? You know, I just want that extra bit of dialogue. I want to milk every bit of it, whereas other players are ready to move on. This person's crafting and they're ready to get going, and then they're having a wait. It's kind of tricky in that regard. So it's a con and a pro. You know, you get a little bit of both out of it. But I think, again, that's where it kind of scales back to that. Like, it's just basically, I think even between you and I, where we're trying to rate it objectively, subjectively, it kind of almost hits that 5 on average, right? You know?
Yeah.
So 5 or 6, really.
Let me read a couple of the quotes from the people that reviewed the game at the time so you can see kind of where the mindset was for these reviewers. IGN says, there's something too safe in War in the North. The gameplay doesn't take any real risks as the combat is fairly simple. The RPG features are part of the course. I never even think of RPG when I think of this game. And the story doesn't make any attempt to stand out in the backdrop of its established universe. He was critical of the bland characters and the inconsequential conversation system, and concluded, while it's admirable that the team had opted to create an original story set alongside the events of the books, you'll wish they had attempted to take more risk with the project. Over at GameSpot, they said they praised the graphics, but were critical of the collision detection, which I don't recall, the autosave feature, and enemy AI. They concluded, there are times in the War in the North where the War in the North shows you the game it could have been, but each time the game starts to hit its stride, it soon stumbles and falls on its face. The last one I'll pull here says, I want to see,
but hey,
Game Informer,
Agadower was cool.
Yeah,
I liked that.
Game Informer says it's clumsy and unpolished. I can only say one good thing about War in the North. It could have been awesome. The conceptual framework is solid, with some extensive tuning and polish. It would be fun to play. Actually, I'm gonna read one more if I can find it here. There was one I wanted to read earlier that I thought said it very well.
I got a quote here. I'm reading this, and this makes me laugh so much because of how vague it is. Unless you want to finish, I'm sorry, I don't mean.
No, you go ahead.
Okay, so the producer, Ruth Tomindel, I may be mispronouncing her name, but she says, you could point to the game's locations on a map of Middle-earth. In fact, we're using the same map that was used in the film as the basis for our world map. Everything in War in the North. Guys, when I read this specific part that you'll know what I'm talking about, I want you to picture Brian, okay? Everything in War in the North that wasn't in the films is based on information from the books. We've been careful to stay as close to the canon as we can. Our writer is a Lord of the Rings expert and a huge J.R.R. Tolkien fan, and he makes sure that everything we do works within the framework of the books. I just picture Brian over there at Snowblind going, "Eee! Gonna put into equals! Eee! Oh, you like Rivendell? We're going to Rivendell. Get excited. Get hyped. Oh, you want Radagast without bird shit? I got you." It's just, I love how big that is. Like, what did she say? Let's see. A writer is a Lord of the Rings expert and huge J.R.R. Tolkien fan. Very, you know, that's a broad statement. You know, where's the?
I feel like he just, this guy is a huge person? Tolkien fan. He's like, maybe he's like, he just watched the movies. He's like, oh, I'm a huge Tolkien fan. Yeah,
you know, that's the thing. Like, you go see like someone who's never experienced Star Wars before. They watch the Skywalker saga, right? And then they go in Walmart and they run into someone with a Star Wars shirt. And they're like, oh shit, you Star Wars fan too? And they're like, yeah, you? And they're like, yeah, I'm a huge fan. You know. And for some people, they're like, I have seen all the books. I read the old canon and the new, you know, I've seen the two Endor movies from the 80s, you know, all this stuff. Whereas that person's like, I've just seen the Skywalker saga.
Man, Josh, I could not.
You laugh because it's so broad, but I love
it. I tried so hard. I had a quote that I wanted to read off, but I know I'm in the right section, but I went over it 7 times. I can't find it. But basically, I thought it was perfectly said. They said that the game never manages to get out of mediocrity, basically. Like, it stays in mediocrity and never is able to reach out of that.
Yeah, that's fair, but, unfortunately.
But, you know, as a final closing statement from me, there's a team out there that worked on this game and built this game, and they delivered a game that has now stuck in me and Josh's memories for a decade. It was an awesome friendship bonding moment, and it gave us more time in a world we love. So, like,
Sorry, I'm sorry, man.
No, it's okay, man.
I'm seeing on the game right now. It's Frodo. Every time I see Frodo, Elijah's Frodo, I think of Brian because the hair.
I appreciate it.
Although Brian's like, he's like three. Brian's like three Frodos stacked on top of one another.
You're right.
I'm sorry, bro. I'm sorry.
No, it's good, man. I think that, you know, the game came out at a bad time. It was pretty mid. It probably shouldn't be a $60 title, even though I'm sure it was developed in a way where it needed to be a $60 title. But looking back on it now, with it being, I mean, it's hard. I think it's probably not easy to pick up. You probably have to go get a used copy or buy it on eBay or buy a CD key.
Throwing it into the eBay Google machine.
If you can pick it up now and play it, it's you know, it's a good, it's a fun experience, you know, and it gave us really good memories. So I thank all the developers out there who made this game.
Oh, wow. There is a Lord of the Rings War in the North Collector's Edition as of this episode. This is going to be dated. Brand new sealed for $107. It's got the quiver.
That's not bad.
No, that's not bad.
It's only went up $27 in 10 years.
A PlayStation 3 version brand new is $28.99.
I need to buy
free shipping. Ask about free shipping. Brand new on Xbox. That is, wow, $35. All right, not that bad. Not that bad. And these are like, some of these are buy nows, not just bids, but buy nows. That's, wow, that's so cool. There's another collector's edition, one sealed for $100. So it's still available, you know? I guess it's not as hard as we thought, but the problem is more so, you better have a 360 to play it.
I missed this, Josh. The game was a commercial failure, selling just over 750,000 units across all platforms. So it didn't even hit a million. But then again, I mean, lifetime, it probably went over a million.
Well, and again, you know, you're releasing this in a time when the movies, people are almost kind of fatigued on milking that aesthetic of the Lord of the Rings trilogy. And I think, you know, we're probably the few and far between who weren't. But now the Hobbit movies are the relevant trilogy, and you're putting out this game just before Skyrim comes out. The whole world is turning its head to look at Skyrim's release that they've been anticipating. No one's going to be looking elsewhere, at least at a time when this, you know, when the titles are going to be releasing around one another. So, like you said, it was just bad timing. What
I
were
found
you
the
say,
whole
though?
Quote that I wanted here, and it perfectly ties into what you were just saying. GameSpy's Leif Johnson, I think his name is Leif Johnson, scored the PC version a 3 out of 5, arguing it never overcomes a sense of enjoyable mediocrity. That's what I said earlier. He felt the game was unlikely to be a success due to the timing of its release amidst such highly anticipated titles as Dark Souls, Battlefield 3, Modern Warfare 3, Batman Arkham City, Uncharted 3, and Skyrim. He concludes, unless you're a Tolkien diehard, you probably would be better off waiting a week for the next fantasy game featuring a struggle in the snow-riddled northern reaches of the world, which he means Skyrim. At its core, War in the North isn't a bad game, it's just merely a disappointing one. So,
Brian, for this game, do you, if you're going to recommend it to people, are you going to say, hey, this is really something you're only going to enjoy if you are a Lord of the Rings diehard?
I would say you need one or two things to make this worth probably be a fun time. You need to really love Lord of the Rings, or you need to play it in co-op.
Yep.
If you don't do one of those two, then I just don't think you're going to like it. I mean, you just probably aren't.
Definitely not going to be as fun as on its own. If I ever replay this game, it's not going to be as fun not having a friend there.
Yeah.
I mean, some of the fun, even though Brian and I played it like pretty straight and narrow, like, I mean, a lot of times you play co-op games, you're like, ah! You're like,
hey, I'm right behind you.
Yeah.
But a little snuggle.
You know, you're just goofing around. Yeah. That kind of makes the fun too.
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, it was a great experience, guys. And I'm glad we finally, this far into our podcasting careers, got time to dedicate an episode to this little mid-game on the side that we love. Josh, you have any final thoughts before I take us out of here?
Yeah, man, just a couple. I mean, I had a really good time being able to get together with Brian and play this game, because usually getting together with him, going into that basement, it just meant that we're going to get some takeout. And Brian and I were usually on the same page with that. And Brian and I were usually very accommodating, too. So Brian and I would do this thing where it was like, if Brian really had his heart set on Chinese, then I might go get, I'd be like, you know what, let's go do it. Or if we decided beforehand we're going to go get some Wendy's beforehand. And then when I meet up with Brian, he's like, okay. He's like, I am game to get Arby's, Josh, just so you know. But what if instead we went to Raising Cane's? And I'm like, ooh, Raising Cane's, I don't know. I really have my heart set on Wendy's. And so what we would end up doing is he might go to one place. We'll go together in the car, but he'll go get his food at A. We'll go drive over then, get my food at B, and then we'll come back. And it was just always fun. It just always made it part of the experience. Brian and I always love getting takeout. We get so hyped for takeout, even though it's 10 minutes into the tummy, you know? But so you pay that money and just eat it so fast. But that was always part of the experience of getting together. And Brian's room was always spotless, but Brian was the type of person that if you go into his room, what I would always call the dungeon, or what in my head at least, but you get to the dungeon and then there's just maybe one sock on the floor. Brian will look at you and go, I'm really sorry about the mess, man, as he picks it up. You know, it's just like, come on, dude. Yeah. But he had, you know,
gotta be immaculate. I showed
pictures in the Discord, but you know, he's got up, you know, Lord of the Rings trilogy posters, Hobbit trilogy posters. He's got Pulp Fiction, Batman posters. He's got all this different stuff in there to kind of like really enhance, you know, it kind of sets the tone when you walk in there, what you're getting into. He's got this entertainment center where on one side you have his collection of Blu-rays. On the other side, it's his collection of physical 360 titles that he was in the midst of still collecting heavily at the time. And you just had all this space in between to kind of sit there and get set up and stuff. Because sometimes when we did the Halo 4 multiplayer, the Gears of War 3 Horde, we would get a couple TVs down there. We were landing it up and we were doing that stuff. So he had a lot of space in that room, and it was always kind of, he had the lighting set really nice, and it was just a good vibe. So sitting in there and playing Lord of the Rings with my buddy, having this new experience together, you know, talking about our thoughts as we played through it, good and bad. You know, it was just a really fun time for the three or so sessions that we played it, you know, and we got that cameo by Justin. That was really fun. And obviously the sad stuff with Robin Williams. But, you know, you just had a really good, it was just a core co-op experience that, you know, it's the only time Brian and I have, we don't have any individual separate memories of playing this game by ourselves. It was always together. And it was really, really cool for that reason. And seeing gameplay for this now, I remember why I have a fondness for it. But yeah, it's kind of mid.
I mean, you nailed it there. There's somebody out in the world that their favorite game of all time is Lord of the Rings War in the North. I wish we could meet them and interview them, because I would just love to hear the passion. But
We did ask in the Discord. I said yesterday, as of this recording, I said, hey guys, we're going to do the episode on this game. If any of you guys have played it or have thoughts on us, you know, send it in, let us know. And everyone in there was pretty much like, I didn't even know about this game.
Yeah.
Or I've never played it. But you kind of had, like, no one really, there's not a whole lot of knowledge about it these days.
Which with all is, those with all surprising. Those games that came out around it, why would anyone have focused on this thing?
That's very true. That's a
even
great
even if you didn't
point,
like Skyrim, you probably point. Liked Call of Duty. If you didn't like Call of Duty, you probably liked Batman. If you didn't like Batman, you probably liked Dark Souls. I mean, there's so much to play at that time.
Yeah.
So
well, that's very
all right, true. Guys.
I think
well,
the reputation took on a different different look when you had the Shadow games coming out. Like those yeah. felt more like big AAA. Like
yep.
people who maybe aren't Middle Earth gamers are going to try this game out. And then they got a lot out of it with the Nemesis system. But this is like very much like, I'm a Lord of the Rings Tolkien expert.
See?
I've read the appendices A to Z. Tom Bombadil, Tommy Boombox is my
that's a
favorite
good,
character.
That's a really good point, Josh, because I think the thing that Middle-Earth games did really well, the Shadow of Mordor, Shadow of War, is that they don't make it feel like you need to be a huge Lord of the Rings nerd to get a lot of enjoyment out of it. It kind of feels like they could have just been a different IP entirely. Whereas this game's like, this is Lord of the Rings, like hardcore all the way. And yeah. if you don't want Lord of the Rings, then that's all you're getting. So
well, and it's but all right, guys. Too, it's a weird distinction. I'm sorry. I'll cut you off.
I'm trying to get the hell out of here, Josh.
Well, hang on, buddy. You have one distinction of like you have like this game where it's just like kind of like we're going to Farnast, we're going southwest by past the Enten Moors. Whereas you have like you know in the Shadow games, it's like oh yeah, by the way. Shelob was hot. She was a woman, a human woman.
That's
you know?
Exactly
and it's
what
just
it is.
Like, and I like Shadow of War, but it's like you have two polar opposites of like, this one's more edgy commercial, but very edgy. And then yeah. you have, you know, one that is very nerdy and just more true to the books.
Yeah,
you don't really
you have like
we haven't
Gandalf.
Really gotten in between yet, a balance.
You have Gandalf in this game being like, some thought we should throw the ring into the sea. And then you get Shadow of Mordor and it's like, I'll slit his throat. It's like, okay,
yeah, you got a bad basically Sauron just slicing dude's throat and bleeding and you know me at the time who saw that when I was booting up Shadow of Mordor I'm like this never happened in the movies. Legolas was surfing down a shield like a skateboard on a railing as he was shooting orcs and there was counting them afterward with his friend Gimli. He killed a Mumakil.
There's no one in the world that was more okay with the lore change of making Shelob a hot chick than Josh.
Thanks,
he was
man.
All for it.
Thanks, man. That's a good
Josh
way to
like,
end it.
Josh is like, this ain't lore accurate, but I don't give a damn. He's behind it day one. So,
well, that's
also, Josh,
too.
I was going to tell you, I know you've been real well behaved this episode, but I got to be honest with you. Because of you, and I'm not saying this just to stroke your ego or to make a joke, I cannot hear the word Mirkwood without also hearing butt cheeks because of you. I only, even if I'm yeah. talking to Erica and we're watching the movie, if I read Mirkwood in the book, I always hear in my head, Mirkwood butt cheeks, because you said that all the time.
I said that about Tariel. What yeah, is it I wanted to eat? Yeah, I'm not even going to say it, but anyway, yeah.
You wanted to eat chicken fingers and fries from your favorite local restaurant.
It was, yeah, that's what we'll
bread.
Go with.
Okay.
That's
yeah.
that's the new canon event. We'll wreck on it, but yeah, thank you for that.
You ready to get the hot yeah. here, Josh?
Let's
all right, guys, let us know if you made it this far through the episode, what you think after us talking about it. Does this make you more interested in playing it? Did we convince you to never bother with it? Let us know. Just ask us questions about it. We'd love to talk about this game more. But we love you guys. Thank you so much for listening to another episode of the Sacred Icon Podcast. And as always, keep it sacred.